stands before an immense adventure. And in a pentagonal-shaped building here, Lilliputians divided into those wearing brown, dark blue, and light blue uniforms scheme and contend as to which shade of pigmentation has a natural right to control this vehicle for that venture into this or that portion of the heavens. At the United Nations, a somewhat similar argument goes on among nationalities instead of uniforms. There they use a phrase that must surely rank among the most arrogant in the human lexicon, the control of space. And there are jubilant headlines today, for the Lilliputians who speak the tongue known as Russian have given up a debating point. They will not insist that those who speak the American tongue must first agree to get out of their airfields in foreign countries before there is agreement about what we shall all do and not do in what particles of outer space, if and when. No doubt, if some words are agreed to on paper about this, many comforting editorials will be written about mankind's essential togetherness in confronting the unknown. But there is not the slightest sign of togetherness in the international confrontation on certain particles of this familiar, very well-known Earth. Government studies here, private studies, informed messages from Europe, all agree that we are in for a rough year with the Russians in various places. They are once again beginning to probe and push and test. No informed person here thinks they will carry any of these initiatives to the point of risking war, but the strain will be considerable. Berlin is always regarded as a kind of thermometer for the Cold War, and right now it is heating up again. Few think they will push this to the point of another blockade, but they are certainly going to force us to give a kind of de facto recognition to the East German communist government, because Germans will replace Russians on such projects as air lane control, and we will have to work with them. It is another step in the Russians' long process of bringing about German unification, if it comes at all, by a deal between the two German regimes and not by free elections. Berlin and the Mideast, these are the certain plague spots for the coming months. Pakistan, another country to fall under military rule, is shaky. There is worry here about Iran and rather acute worry about Iraq. The stretch of land inhabited by the Kurdish tribes is a natural corridor between Russia and the heart of the Mideast. This stretch involves parts of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. The Turks will probably hold fast, but we may see a Russian-inspired effort to set up an independent Kurdistan that might work in the shakier countries. Communism by no means equates with Nasserism, and such a move, among other results, may block Nasser's ambitions in the northern stretches. This could serve a double Russian purpose, for it would tend to shift Nasser's efforts to Africa, to the Sudan, and to Libya, where we have a vital air base. Morocco is already demanding we quit our bases there. Tunisia's Bourguiba is already seeking arms from communist countries. France has not yet proved she can settle the rebellion in Algeria. Hypothetical peace in outer space does not yet compensate for turmoil across North Africa and the Middle East, in the view of most responsible authorities here. Political reporters possess a broad streak of romanticism. They tend to put their emphasis on the adjective, not the noun, in the term political science. Persons attract or repel them more surely than programs. Party weighs less in their measurements than personality. And they are always instinctively looking for individual men cut in a pattern a little larger than life. They are always prepared to be disappointed, and usually are, but they go on looking. Around the beginning of 1952, a sudden rash of articles and columns appeared about a new politician most Americans had never heard of. He was the man then in his first term as governor of Illinois, and his name was Stevenson. The rash of publicity appeared an organized, calculated event to the naked eye, but it was not. It was entirely the coincidence of reporters and editors, partly motivated by scuttlebutt amongst themselves, beating individual trails to the governor's mansion in Springfield and coming away considerably impressed. What they separately wrote had a remarkable collective result, and the Stevenson boom was born. This is by way of suggesting that something of the same kind of process, though on a less resounding scale, is quite likely to happen again. The potential beneficiary or victim of this process is Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee. He has been in the headlines occasionally, is right now, with his impressive proposals on limiting atomic weapons testing, but he remains pretty much a stranger to the country at large. In spite of 20 years in House and Senate, in spite of his record as one of the most effective senators of the last 2 or 3 years. The election this month suggests that the people want new faces and voices. The immediacy and saturation effect of modern communications not only creates a celebrity in a hurry, it can also wear out his welcome in a hurry. The potential Democratic candidates for president and vice president, Stevenson, Humphrey, Symington, Johnson, Minor, Williams, Kennedy, young as most of them be, are already unexcitingly familiar to professional observers here. And unless our own antenna is entirely corroded, we detect the beginnings of a shift of attention to Gore of Tennessee. If the keep the South in sentiment of the last two Democratic conventions prevails in 60, Gore as a Southerner would have much the same acceptability to the North as Stevenson, a Northerner, had to the South. And his Southern colleagues do not feel the same antipathy toward him that they felt toward Kefauver. This in spite of the fact that Gore refused to sign the Southern Manifesto on Segregation and did vote for the Civil Rights Bill. Gore knocked out the powerful Senator McKellar in the 52 primary, beat a popular former governor in this year's primary by an even greater margin, and won this month over his nominal Republican opposition by 80% of the vote, the highest winning margin in any senatorial contest in the country. Gore does not have Stevenson's brilliance, but he possesses relative youth, he's 50, personal attractiveness, and a driving, digging mind that has won the respect of Washington intellectuals. Quite a feat for a man whose degrees come from a teacher's college and a YMCA night course in law. If he does have national ambitions, he's his own worst enemy. He has no publicity sense or machinery. His official biography, the Congressional Directory, consists of exactly 3 lines. But there is something about him, as there was in a more incandescent way about Stevenson, that is very likely to draw the wavering spotlight in his direction in the months ahead. This is Eric Severide in Washington. Good evening. There now appears a real chance that the expected $12 billion deficit for this fiscal year's federal budget will not go that deep. Much depends on what supplemental spending the new Congress grants between January and July. But hopes are rising that the business upturn will reduce the deficit. By how much will be known generally when the December 15 income tax returns are in, and rather specifically when the January returns show the rate of comeback in business profits. But it's still clear that the total deficit will be high, and still clear that the number one personal project of President Eisenhower in his last 2 years will be to get government spending in hand. The president is an orthodox conservative thinker on economics. His advisors are more sophisticated, but are themselves fundamentally orthodox, old-fashioned in the view of some modern school economists. They remain deeply worried about inflation, though the commodity price index has been showing stability for several months. In the long haul, however, the inflationary engine is pretty certain to go on pumping. The mail received at the Treasury has changed in its emphasis. Last summer, it was dominated by letters from business executives suggesting ways to prime the pump to stimulate business. Right now, it is dominated by the simpler appeals of individuals who live on pensions, fixed salaries, and insurance, who plead for a stop to inflation. And these letters have a haunting effect on the minds of officials here. The dominating administration activity will be efforts at reducing government's contribution to inflation by paring here and there, as with the attempt just announced to go over the foreign aid programs with a fine-tooth comb. What one does not find here, however, is any high-level exercise in looking at our economic practices through radically new spectacles. No one is really looking at the tax structure, for example, in terms of its morality. The basic philosophy of our tax system is the encouragement of capital formation, not of individual sweat and skill. Only money really makes keeping money under this system. A tax system that permits, for example, a very rich man to educate his children or to possess works of art virtually for nothing through trust and deed arrangements contains the germs of a sense of social injustice, the avoidance of which is a prime responsibility of leadership in any democracy. Nor is serious thought given to the argument that inflation is a permanent condition in this century, that a truly stable dollar is an illusion, that our pension, insurance, and bond practices are based on the abnormal deflationary period of the 19th century. To the argument that the fixed incomes of smaller people might be unfixed, determined by the cost of living index, as is done in certain labor union contracts, increasing inflation, no doubt, but making its effects universal. Little attention is paid to a corollary argument that another way of alleviating the severe injustices of inflation might be to steadily replace wages and salaries as such with payments in the form of stock ownership. This is Eric Sebright in Washington.